to be heard from the west to the east. I worked in my craft and I prayed for my time on the scene. The man have never left my team. 19, learned the right creed. Nah, I'm not a right breed, but I might be. In my crease, Nikes, hit up my G. I'll still never sell out my theme. Well, you know about heritage. You go inherited. Don't chill with the snakes.
Okay, so Lord Dr. Michael Hastings is hands down one of the most accomplished people I know. He's a personal friend and mentor, but he's also the president of Zane, ex-KPMG, ex-BBC, works with UNICEF, is the chancellor at SOAS. I couldn't properly introduce him because he does so many things. He's also not a new name or face on this podcast. So if you're listening or watching, you probably know about him already. In this particular episode, we talk about a bunch of different things. We talk about Ukraine a little while. We spend a little bit of time, too, on Russia's endgame and what Putin's really playing at. And then we get into what I think is the meat of this, which is we get into him, how he does all the various things he does, how he chooses what roles to do, how he balances his time. But also, we talk about the next generation. What's his advice for young people today as they navigate the world? Folks, this is an amazing episode. I would implore you to take a listen. And of course, if you enjoy it, do like, do follow, do subscribe. Enjoy this episode. Lord Michael Hastings, thank you so much for doing this. I was just telling you off air that our last interview was pretty spirited, I think might be one word.
Robust.
I should tell people though, you know, we have a very good and close relationship off air, because I know some people are like, where were you guys going back and forth so much? You know, is he okay? Are you all right? And I was like, hold on, you know, this is very much an in-house conversation. It was a family conversation. It wasn't anything crazy. For those who haven't listened, they should go back. It was about the royal family and you were talking about how the system really works.
Yes, I was. I was helping people to understand the mysterious aspects of monarchy, which many of which need to remain mysterious. I mean, part of the privilege, but also the potential, the power of monarchy is that you only know the little you need to know. And it's not necessary for the whole world to intrude in on the details of the operation. That's not to say it's secret. It's just to say it's mysterious. And monarchy is based on a very important, almost heritagely biblical principle that God is the king and you and I are the subjects. And in that line of accountability, the king is able, or in this case, the queen, to make decisions of determination that we may not know the answer or the reason why. And so there's a choice. You know, we choose to live here in the United Kingdom. By living here in the United Kingdom, we have a sovereign, and our sovereign is Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. And there are consequences that flow from that. A bishop in the Church of England makes a choice, as does a vicar, to be subject to the sovereign.
Yeah.
But so does every police officer, and so does every army officer, and so do the judges of the courts, and so do your elected members of parliament, and so do your local councillors, and so do the members of the House of Lords and the members of the Supreme Court. We live in a sovereign democracy.
Well,
now, if you ask me to explain the fine details of that day-to-day operation, I'd say read the court circular in the Times.
You know, and this isn't the topic of today. For some reason, I think something must have happened with Ukraine because I keep getting lots of messages, and that's how I know I'm staying up to date with things. You know, I do want to jump there. Actually, I would love to get your take on just what's going on. You know. The issue with this podcast sometimes is we don't record it exactly when it goes out, so we don't know what's the latest news. And you know, the truth is, whatever we say could be a day in a couple of minutes or hours. But if you could speak generally to the issue, Lord Hastings, what are some of the things you would like to say about what's going on over in Ukraine right now?
There's an old adage which says lies, lies, and damn lies. And we were all led by lies to believe that Russia had no bad intention towards Ukraine. I even watched live just 2 days ago the Russian foreign minister attempting to explain to international journalists, which included a journalist from Channel 4, that effectively civilians were not targets, military ambition was the only interest here, and that Russia was effectively trying to send a hard signal to the West, which is all about boundaries, using the phrase, they're listening, but they haven't heard us. And that boundaries are going to be defined by military action, which states very clearly, cross the boundary, which is ideological and physical. And you can see the consequence, which is destruction, death, and the ripping up of lives. And I say lies, lies, and damn lies, because the things we were led to believe in the multi-month-long process of negotiations of multiple visits of leaders from every corner of the world to Moscow in order to negotiate, to discuss. And there was a constant aura of no, no, this isn't going to happen. No, this isn't going to happen. Now we're seeing it happen violently, persecutingly, punishingly, destructively. My father was part of the British Defence Group for the Second World War. He was a medical orderly. And many people of my generation will have had family who remember what it was like to see people running for shelter because bombs were on their way. And they were mainly, of course, to a large extent, much greater in Central Europe than they were certainly here in the United Kingdom. But people remember what it was like to be in the dark, to be in shelters, to be down, buried in basements, to worry, to fear, to stress, to fret. But to see in 2022, and as I speak, 1.33 million people have become refugees as of today, departing into the five neighboring countries adjacent to Ukraine. Thank God for their acceptance. But what have these people left behind? They've left behind the ordinary joys that you and I take for granted.
Yeah.
Schools for their children, the right to walk to the shops, electricity and water in their taps, their own broadcasting system, their own cultural realities. All this has been left behind. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of cars abandoned at train stations all over the country as people had to drop and go. This is how an enemy forces people through fear and intimidation, let alone through bombing and destruction, to cow them. And of course, no one can be confident that the Russian president understands the boundary between Ukraine and the neighboring countries, because he doesn't understand the boundaries between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. And as we saw, the stealing of dimensions of Ukrainian land from 2014 onwards, in fact, from 2008 onwards, there's a long, difficult history to this. And one of the things I'd say, Mike, is that the advantage of the BBC, can I mention that great institution? The advantage of the BBC is if you go on to BBC Sounds, you'll find there's a mountain of really valuable podcast material about Ukraine. There's in particular, a remarkable half an hour description of how did we get here?
Yeah.
Which has a group of historians who explain how conflicts between Ukraine and Russia take us right back into the early 1900s. And we need to understand that those claims made by the Russian president that these were the same country is blatantly untrue. It never was the same country. They never were the same people. But this is how falsehood and deceit, which is perpetrated on a people, and as we speak again this afternoon, literally today, the Russian Duma has passed law prohibiting criticism of what they see as false news and information, prohibiting criticism of their perspective of the destructive killing of what is going on in Ukraine. So we have to see that this is a despotic and evil regime, and it will need to be treated accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things to pick up there. I mean, the one really interesting thing to me, at least, that you mentioned is just on the reality, if you like, of what war is. You know, my generation, if you like, war's been gamified. You know, where you know, we think about Call of Duty and Battlefield and games like this. You know, and with all the 24/7 news coverage, there is a degree to which it just seems like moving parts of any kind of normal story. But of course, it's lives, it's people. We've saw the treatment of black people. We've saw seen people displaced. You know, we're talking about potential humanitarian crisis, war crimes. I mean, we could go on. At risk of making this podcast solely about Ukraine, which I don't want to do, I would love to get your thoughts about what Russia's long game is here. And I know this is very difficult, and most commentators, you know, would scratch their head because there are a number of ways this conflict could go. There's different places it could lead. But what do you see here as kind of Russia's long plan? You know, for folks often refer to, you know, Putin as irrational. I was listening to a conversation today where someone kind of phrased it differently. They said he's not irrational. He's rational, but he has a different rationality. He has different ends, different goals. What do you think his end game is?
Well, the one thing we can definitely not say is that we don't know precisely what the end game might be, because we don't. We think the end game, according to the prescription of the first assaults, is to claim the territory of Ukraine and to take back its political center, Kiev, and the people of its political center back into Moscow's arms. We don't know if that is the end game, because we're watching something which has been stated by the very perpetrators as not going to happen. So we don't know. And I don't know when we will know. It could be weeks, it could be months before we actually see a cessation of hostilities and we get some clarity on boundaries. We don't know. But what we do know is this. Don't sit pretty, any of us, thinking that the pleasure lives we've had the opportunity to indulge in since the end of the Second World War would never, ever be dented or affronted. Now we're watching the same conflicting and violent realities, the same race-orientated description, the same taking away of fundamental rights, the same use of codified information around Nazism, and the threat of a different culture group and a different ethnic group. We're seeing the same behaviors that were evident in the 1930s that took the world to war. The same behaviors. So I say to everybody, come on. This is a time to batten down the hatches. It's a time to save so that you can be financially astute and responsible. It's a time to take cognizance of the privileges of your life and therefore don't abuse them, but make sure that you relish every moment of what you can do wisely. It's a time to make sure we understand the flows of history and that we can think wisely about how nations conduct themselves with integrity. So we must treat our vote as something that deeply matters. And I hope by the next time we have an election, either local or regional or national, that we will get out there and vote. Because if we don't vote, we'll become indifferent. We, you know, we often say, well, you get the government you deserve. You get the government that you're careless about. And you know, we could say many things about the government we sit under in the United Kingdom, but thank goodness, no matter whether our perspective is left or right or center, thank goodness it is accountable.
Yeah.
It is exposable. It is transparent for all the things it may do wrong. Those weekly times of prime minister's questions, those endless questions in parliament, those endless questions in the House of Lords, those endless select committees, the endless public scrutiny, a media which is vibrant and determined. Thank goodness for all of that. And that we can put right the foolishness of vacant minds. But what's the end game from Russia? It's not about saying it's anybody's guess. History tells us one thing about ideologues and despots. It's all about grab, take, and destroy. That's what we're witnessing now.
Yeah.
But where the border is, nobody knows.
Yeah, I heard it said once that dictators win in the short term, but democracies always win in the long term. And so, you know, where that meta arc kind of bends, you know, we don't know, but we know at least, you know, some of his ambitions. I want to park the conversation on Ukraine, just because we've had it so many times, and you are very fascinating for a number of different reasons. And I think some people listening, rather than us, you know, simply going back and forth on what we believe, I think hearing about who we are would also be really interesting. And I think it would be really fascinating to hear about you. So, you know, we don't have much time, hence why, you know, I've got kind of something I wanted you to speak about, and something we've spoken about privately, but I thought it would benefit folks listening to this podcast and watching it to get a sense too. So at the start of this podcast, I read out your bio. I said a bit about what you do. I mean, the truth of the matter is you can never be fully introduced, Michael. I think you probably know this. You get to a certain stage, you just can't be fully introduced anymore, right? You kind of have to pick something. Well, he's a nice guy. Because you just couldn't read out the bio. But you've had experience at BT, UNICEF, KPMG, My Brother's Keeper, Vodafone, the BBC, House of Lords. Here's what I thought would be interesting to hear from you. What governs all your work? What's the golden thread that goes through all of them? And how do you decide what to do? Because you must be somebody who's offered different things, who has different things kind of floating around him. But how do you decide what to do when you've done so many different things?
And still do so many different things. You didn't mention that I'm also chairman of SAAS at the University of London. So the multitude...
That's a new appointment. Congratulations on that, of course. But how do you do it?
How do you do it? Well, here's the key thing. And I end up explaining this to people maybe 100 times a week, because it's a really important principle. Well, every one of us has the choice to be crystal clear about what our purpose is and what principles we will choose to live by. Or we can be completely open to empty-headed options in every direction without any foundational clarity. And therefore, we will wander from role to role, from place to place, from job to job, from income to income, or even end up at the end of a certain period of time with no understanding of what our aim has been, where we've been seeking to go. So at the age of 16, and you know this, Mike, I was asked by my very dear friend at school, what am I going to do with my life? What I want it to be about? Now, I do think that's actually a very good 16-year-old question. And I came out with a statement on that day around the gardens of the school where he and I were both pupils at 16, and I've never changed it, never forgotten it, and I've never lost it, and this is it. To speak up for the poor and to bend the power of the prosperous to the potential of the poor. What I knew at 16, having been in a very fractured environment in Jamaica, where I had witnessed the breakdown of democracy. And ironically, because the Jamaican people had at that juncture sought a political alliance with its neighbor Cuba, which of course was in alliance with the then USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Because of that, to be frank, there was an invasion of the economy by the West, the Americans, the British, Europeans, to say, come on, you can't make choices like that. There had been a Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s, in which there had to be negotiations between the USSR and the United States to remove potential weaponry from Cuba's land space. It did involve, of course, partially as well, an agreement that Turkey would remove some of its weapons that were facing towards Russia. But that compromise led to a peace agreement for the people of Jamaica to vote for a government that kind of wanted to play poker with that option was done. But what it led to was savage poverty in the streets, lack of facilities in the shops and public services, absence of products on the shelves, people's incomes swallowed up, pensions disappeared, banking in crisis. I saw vivid and desperate poverty before my own eyes as a child. And I was very conscious that what I'd seen, even in the semi-pleasant environment of Montego Bay, Jamaica, was but a smidgen of the reality of what was then, at that point in the 1970s, we were talking about half the world's population living on less than $2.50 a day. Now, thankfully, we've seen massive change in that. But the numbers of those still in extreme and needy poverty has just exceeded a billion again. The consequence of COVID pushed the numbers back up from roughly 750 million at $1.50 a day up to the billion at $1.50 a day. And major crises, a food crisis in the world, where the World Food Programme has to make substantial appeals, although funded by governments, it's not sufficient to meet the needs of growing food crisis and lack of food reserves. And that poverty, that is so important for the dignity of individuals that they're actually able to live their lives without the perpetual stress of lack of water, lack of sanitation, lack of food, lack of sound living. So all of that to me is a driver. And therefore, everything I do, whether it's directly supporting individuals because they need help and support because of poverty of mind, poverty of spirit, poverty of income, or supporting institutions or causes because of poverty of mind, spirit, or income, or supporting people, as I do frequently, who are incarcerated because they too are subjects of systems that may disrespect their dignity, and they have been subject because they couldn't pay for legal systems to defend them. So whatever I do is associated closely, speaking up for the poor, bending the power of the prosperous to the potential of the poor.
Hey there, just a quick one. I want to encourage you, if you're enjoying this podcast episode, do hit that follow or subscribe button. It helps this podcast grows, and it means we can get even more guests on the show. It takes a few seconds, but it makes a massive, massive difference. So hit the subscribe button or the follow button if you're listening to this podcast. Thank you very much. Back to the conversation. That's amazing, Mike. You know, some people listening may say, well, hold on, Mike, how did that come to you? Because that's very pithy. It sounds very kind of well put together. It's very well structured. And they may say, hold on, so, but how did that just dropped on you? Was it like Paul and he's wrote to Damascus and, you know, he was kind of hit with a, like, how did you come to know that? Because the reality for so many people might be, yes, they're passionate about music. Yes, they care a bit about kind of those who have less than them, but it's like a mesh of interest and passions. There's not one dominant, you know, piercing passion. Oh, that's because I'm good at alliteration. So, how did it come to you? And what would you say to them if they go, well, I've got about six different things I'm kind of interested in?
I'd say don't be interested in six different things. Have a clear purpose, which is definable and statable. Make it into a sentence. So, you know, it's not a paragraph, it's not a book. It's a clear, definable purpose to enable, to empower, to facilitate, whatever it happens to be. And then that's your canopy. And under your canopy are the activities you do, the way you live, the principles you live by, the priorities you put in place, the way you spend money that lives out those principles. And lives under the canopy of that purpose. If it's just I'm interested in lots of stuff, what will happen is as the years and the months go by, you wear it away. And from 16 to 64, it has never left me. It has not worn away. It has empowered and engulfed me. It has actually put me on flames because I want to continue to be excited about that purpose and to do what I can. So even working as I did in a major commercial institution in KPMG for 13 years, the ability to move the institution, its partners, its leaders, to move them towards grabbing prioritization for the poor, putting investments of millions and millions and millions of dollars into supporting people in the poorest parts of the world by building sustainable enterprise, building villages that actually had livable, personable, dignified sanitation, water services, education, housing, job creation, banking, electrification. These things are so essential. And to be able to advocate for it, I think is fantastic, but also to do it. And with that particular case in KPMG, a tiny village on the edge of an island off the coast of Tanzania, it took us 9 years to do the project work, the physical building and facilitation. I went every year for 9 years without fail, every August, taking a team of assessors and auditors with me to make sure the money was being acutely well spent, but also vitally, 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 that we were on plan for the development we were doing. I remember somebody in the business once saying, you know, there's no business to be won for us here if we do this. We're not going to get any gain from doing this. And that was exactly perfect, because I said, no, we're not. We're doing this because we can, not because we'll win, but because we can. That mantra is vital.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me as what you're saying almost, maybe we, when we're thinking about how to arrange our lives, should be specific about the goal, but flexible about the process, in the many different things may come up in our lives that, you know, we do, but they all kind of angle us towards kind of where we ought to be in the end. One interest I know we both share is leadership. I know we're very passionate about leadership. You are the first ever recipient of the Stephen R. Covey Leadership Award. I know that you are a professor in leadership, and it's something you talk about often, even in our private conversations. I want to do two things. I want to talk about leadership a little bit, but before we do that, I want you to just rate, if you like, some leaders. And I'm going to ask you to recall some of the most impressive leaders you've ever met or you've seen or you've watched. And you can have that going in the back burner, so that can be a tab. But before we go there, how would you rate Boris Johnson's leadership in as little words as you can use?
Clearly esteemed and adequate for his supporters, unacceptable to the rest of us.
That's good. Putin?
At the moment, destructive and deceitful. The lowest grade. I don't think there's a number.
Joe Biden?
Trying very hard to stay awake. But I do accredit him with taking before the American people, through its Congress and its Senate, legislation to restore America's cracked, fractured, and desperate infrastructure. All power to the man for doing that. I, like you, have been in America's cities, and I've seen the reality. Let's not pretend. It's not heaven on earth. But that is a way to deliver jobs and security and to invest in America's future. At the same time, the rebalancing of America's fiscal debt is a vital need. And the only way to do that, and this is even difficult to say at a time at which we're facing conflict in Eastern Europe, is America's excessive and ballooned defense budget should be constrained. It's one thing to have what's necessary to keep the world safe. It's another thing to be over the top about it on an annual basis.
Let's do two more. These are the two bonus ones, right? Barack Obama.
Fine man. Good effort. And I believe he intended exceptional things. But I remember that his first executive act in office was to sign an order on day one requiring the closing of Guantanamo Bay within 12 months. We are now 13 years on, and it's still open.
Well, but I wonder if that's his... let's not go too much into that, because, it's funny because Biden is governing somewhat like Obama, but lacks the stamina. And the kind of the finesse, if you like, needed. But before we go there, here's the last one. Here's the last bonus one.
It better be a woman.
Oh gosh, I'm just thinking about the last few major leaders. It actually wasn't a woman.
But we better talk about Angela Merkel.
I know you want that. But before we go there,
and she is AAA star with 5 stars, 3 to 5, 8-star general.
I'll take it, but I think people will be shouting at me if you don't talk about Trump. So, a couple of words.
Who?
An orange man. I don't know if you've heard about him. He's he says you're fired on some show in America.
Oh, okay. Next one.
So, all these people are leaders, of course, of countries, but. Of course, it's not only leading a country that makes you a leader. There's many, many different ways we can, or everyone listening to this and watching this, can be leaders in their, say, day-to-day life. So if you had to define leadership, if you like, you know, what would you say it is?
Lead is to enable. You only lead when you're sure that others are following. But the aim of their following is to allow them to go in front. And one of the great credits that I really believe was valid, entirely valid for Angela Merkel, is she was described by Time magazine as the leader who leads in the shadows. She leads from behind, solid, sensible, enabled, intelligent, perceptive. For 16 years, she led the people of Germany with great exception and without corruption, without undue criticism. Her one tough, difficult area was to receive into Germany 1 million refugees, which was highly criticized at the time because, of course, they were coming from the war in Syria. But they've been settled. They've either learned the German language or been accommodated into communities. They've found jobs. They've been housed. She was right to do it. We're now facing another migration, mass migration crisis, and it's going to require stateswomen and statesmen to stand out, not by saying what's the minutiae interests of my own country, which is people liking to keep themselves protected and safe. We all want that. But what is the statesperson's responsibility, which is to stand up for the dignity of others, particularly those displaced, despised, and forgotten. And that is what she did with great aplomb. Look for a grand speech from Angela Merkel anywhere. You won't find it. Look for a platform rally from Angela Merkel. You won't see it. But some of the other people you mentioned, the only place they ever seem to thrive is on the platform, when the real work is to know how to do what is necessary to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God.
This is good. I want to probe into that because I had an interesting conversation on the last episode because I was going through a bit of a moment, and you can help me. This is kind of public therapy where, you know, take Black Lives Matter and the campaigns we all saw a few years ago. Everyone was on board to say, we've got to do things different. We've got to change things. Great. We all agreed. Then after we put the placards down and we actually have to work, some people are very vehemently opposed to working with the police, working with these corrupt institutions, and think that there's something about their maybe purest intentions, belief, integrity, whatever you want to call it, that's compromised that's sullied, if you like, when you get involved with these institutions, these structures. What would you say to those people? I mean, do you get where they're coming from? And do you get why a lot of young people who complain about the system don't think they should fraternize with the system, instead are kind of advocating building almost subsystems or separate systems from the thing, because they don't want to be compromised? Do you get that impulse? And what would you say to that impulse?
Well, that impulse is called QAnon from the United States, and to be found here in the UK as well. People who decide that they know a better way to deliver democracy, so they'll storm the Capitol and remove the vice president and get rid of the elected representatives, and they'll do it their way, and in the process kill six people. I mean that is what the reality of all these alternative, you know, I don't want to go with institutions and systems is. I understand very well people's skepticism, but to every skeptic the answer is very simple: get involved. If you're worried about education systems and teaching and so on, well, take the plunge. Someone in your family, your network, your friends, become teachers. Join the system.
But they will say the system. They will say the system corrupts. That when you join it, so the police officer is the classic case. They go a police officer who's black, who's got noble intentions. When he joins the system, the force in and of itself, they change him. And so he goes in. And politics, you know the criticism with politicians. They all go in with lovely ambitions of building local schools and local. The minute they get in, the argument is they get corrupted. What would you say to that person?
Well, I don't recognize that description of politicians, because if you want to see the success of the academy's network, you go to every community in the United Kingdom and see the great things done on schools over the course of the last 20 years. So that's a criticism that is unfair on both Labour and the Conservatives. They've delivered a new infrastructure for education, and it's right to applaud it. But when I understand the point you're making, but here is the bigger point. In goes, as you say, the single black policeman or woman, and then finds that the system is grabbing them by the throat and pulling them left or right, wants to get them down to the lowest level. If instead of one policewoman and policeman went in, but 1,000 policemen and policewomen, or 10,000 policemen and policewomen went in, of the 100,000 in the UK, went in to the service of the police in the same way went into the military services, went into the fire services, went into the education services. When we were all battling our way through COVID in the last 2 years, 2020 and 2021, we had to be damn grateful for whoever it was that was providing the oxygen services for people in emergency care, or the people who were injecting us in our arms if we were receiving vaccines. And we weren't asking questions about the color of the people. We were saying, just thank goodness they're there. We realized how vital it is that we need people in what seems to be unfairly lower paid public services, in the same ways we needed all the delivery people, all the supermarket people, all the people who were making sure that our energy was flowing, that our electricity was on, that we had Wi-Fi. So many people from commercial to public, we need them. And the tragedy of how we think in our society is, well, those people are in the basic necessity utility jobs. Well, those people became utterly vital to life and times. And I've always contended and argued, it's the people at the bottom who should be paid substantially more and the people at the top substantially less. Because the ones at the bottom carry the burden of the dignity of life. The ones at the top make decisions to oversee it. We need to normalize the balance between the two. And we need a much more Nordic approach. The countries of the North, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and Sweden have a much more balanced economic structure than we do, which respects positions according to their value and impact in society. So let's have nobody saying, you know, if it's impossible for black people to go anywhere and change it. Not true. Absolutely not true. We actually are seeing the authority and the significance of black people in government, in this government now, people from different ethnic cultures. We can see the potential in the Labour Party and the opposition. We can see it. We can hope and believe that whichever party comes to power at the next election, that the nature, even on this very day that we're having this conversation, a new black woman MP has been elected to a Midland seat. We've got to say thank goodness for the transformation which has happened in the last 40 to 50 years that wasn't there before. And when you think back to old speeches about rivers of blood and the need to separate migrants from the mainstream, those kind of things are finished and out the window. We now have a much more integrated, positive and positive possibilities society. So let's see everybody taking up those possibilities instead of sitting there whinging about systems and services. Join them, participate, get involved, take the reality, but see it as service to build a wider opportunity for others.
Superb. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, you know, I just want to make sure all thoughts are represented on in this conversation. So I thought I would share that with you, because that is a concern a number of people have. Well, I know we're pressed for time, and the truth is we could carry on forever. But, you know, as it goes, there's more engagements, there's more things to do. And I always ask you to leave my listeners, viewers, with some wisdom. I always feel like this is me visiting, like, my uncle's house. And he says, oh, when I was your age, you know, and he says something. So if you had to conjure up just a smidget of wisdom for us before you leave, what would you say to my generation? As this has become a kind of, you know, a thing where we always end these podcasts with you speaking to a younger version of yourself. But what would you say to us if you had to say something to us?
Especially at a time like this, for any intelligent observer of the tragedies on our screens and the sounds in our ears, two things. Please, now see that life is not about indulgence. You may think that just by the accumulation of assets or of material or of money, that your life is a flow and ease. No, we all live with risk. And because we live with risk and very high risk, the greatest joy in our lives is to reach out our hand to those in more severe risk than us. So I'd say to your generation, please wake up, smell the coffee, and see that the nature of the risk of the world around you requires you to give, and to give more of yourself. That's number one. Number two, patience. If your generation has something almost in a way worse than COVID, it is that your generation is too impatient to deliver essential goods, always wanting to move ahead, move on, tweeting ourselves out of existence, TikToking constantly, perpetually on to the next swipe. But patience says that great things are built through energy, enthusiasm, integrity, and diligence. That's patience. Patience will allow foundations to go firm.
And that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much. I should say, you know, other Facebook is also a poison. So be careful about Facebook too and all the other social media outlets. They're all not good. But thank you so much for that. That was brilliant. Yeah. Hey, just before you go, thank you so much for listening to this whole conversation. Not many people make it this far, so thank you for doing so. If you liked it, please don't just leave. Hit the follow button or the subscribe button and leave us a review if you're listening to it. If you really enjoyed it, then please consider sharing it with somebody who you like or maybe someone you even don't like. Just copy and paste the link and send it to somebody. Thank you so much and see you next week. Peace.
Wanna be heard from the west to the east. I worked in my craft and I prayed for my time on the scene. The man I've never left my team. 19, look the right creed. Nah, I'm not a right breed, but I might be. In my crease, Nikes, hit up my G. I'll still never sell out my theme. Well, you know about heritage, you go inherited. Don't chill with the snakes.